If Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Peter and Paul, James and Jude were all present on this beautiful May Mother's Day morning, which one do you think might most appropriately be invited to deliver the sermon? My personal pick would be Luke, who shows more sensitivity to women and has more tender stories about their encounters with Christ than any other gospel. We're going to think about one of those stories for the next few minutes. And while it's true that all four gospels tell this particular one, it is Luke's version of it that has the greatest warmth and appeal. The story goes like this. Jesus is invited to have dinner with a religious leader by the name of Simon. One has the sense that this little party is not altogether congenial. Simon, after all, overlooks one of the common courtesies to Jesus in not having his feet bathed in welcome when he comes into the house. But they are washed a little later, by accident, when an uninvited guest, a woman, comes into the room, stands behind Jesus as he reclines on a low couch at the table, loses her composure and begins to weep, and then when the tears drop on his feet, bends down to wipe them off with her hair. When she also kisses his feet, it's obvious that she is deeply grateful for some favor to a person she considers much superior to herself. The host, Simon, is puzzled when Jesus accepts this homage without a rebuke, because he has recognized this woman as a well-known outcast, and he cannot imagine why Jesus, if he is truly the prophet he is said to be, would not also recognize her and be embarrassed by her intimacies. Even a respectable woman would not dare to be that familiar in public, much less someone who is almost certainly a notorious prostitute. Simon must have looked both offended and smug, because Jesus rebukes him sharply for his own lack of love and then tells a little story to explain the woman's tidal wave of emotion. The gist of it is that people who are forgiven a great deal are filled with a corresponding love and gratitude in return. It is a tense and awkward moment. No wonder all four gospel writers remember this story, although in a perfectly human way, they recall some of the details differently. In one version, the tension is caused by the fact that the woman is so extravagant. She has brought a jar of expensive perfumed lotion, and she pours out all of it to anoint Jesus. It was a normal courtesy in that hot, dry country to anoint the head and sometimes the beard of a guest with a fragrant, cooling ointment of some kind, their version of Old Spice. But she has really gone to excess. She has bought a lotion that cost 300 denarii, almost a year's salary for a day laborer. The disciples, most of whom had fished for a living, are absolutely astonished. probably as naive about such high living as I was one day, a long time ago, on leave from my army unit, when I wandered into Guerlain's in Paris to buy some perfume as a gift and saw prices that made me marvel how any woman could put on her wrist and throat in one day what it would cost me a month's pay to buy. So the disciples say, feeling very prim and righteous, why didn't this woman sell the ointment and give the money to the poor instead of dumping it out like this all at once? From what I read about him in other places, I assume that what she did was not what Jesus would have preferred himself if he had had a choice. But this is a poignant moment marked by the reckless extravagance of a deep and grateful love, and he is not about to hurt the woman's feelings. So he says, and it is surely one of the simplest and most natural of all the statements recorded of him, she has done a beautiful thing. Not practical, perhaps, but beautiful. I would like to think that insofar as he is concerned, this world is not simply utilitarian. We can live without flowers or stars or dolphins racing ahead of a sailing ship or red-winged blackbirds swooping over a farm pond, but it will be life enormously diminished. Here is a moral dilemma. Do I buy the child a new coat in place of the old one, if I must choose between two good things, or do I take the child to see a play which she's never seen before and fill her head with images of beauty and possibility that feed the soul and may ultimately transform her life? How does one strike the right balance between beauty and bread? I had a friend in seminary who did summer work among the poor of Appalachia. He went back into those hills and hollows among the wretched shacks, and he couldn't resist, he told me, lecturing them on how to spend their money. I mean, they had nothing, he said. And yet here and there you'd see flower boxes, trinkets, whatnots in the window ledges, a little throw rug, and maybe a cat. And I'd say, look, what are you doing wasting money on this stuff? Most of them didn't have a car. So some of them would walk to the junkyard, get an old shell of a car, put it up on blocks, and buy imitation leopard skin seat covers down at the Walmart store. And then on Sundays, they would pile into it with a picnic basket of peanut butter sandwiches and pretend they were going someplace. And this friend of mine would say to them, look, potatoes. Not flowers. You need food. You can't eat roses. And these trinkets, you've got to learn how to use your money more wisely. And then when you have some to spare, you can graduate to the flowers and the whatnots. And then he said, Bob, they paid no attention to me at all because they knew I was wrong. When they got down to their last dime, They spent it on something they thought was beautiful as a way of announcing to the world, we are not animals. You know, when people lived in caves, they took berry juice and made art on the walls. When they had little more than a pile of sticks, somebody took one of the sticks and made a flute and played music. When some of them were sold into the chains of slavery, they learned to drag the chains to some invincible rhythm and to sing. I was a child during the Great Depression when it was a struggle for my father to pay the rent and buy the groceries. But he was extravagant at times in his love of my mother and of my sister and me. And he would bring us a gift, some gift that had absolutely nothing to do with the need to survive. My mother would fuss a little about his robbing the cracker tin to get the money for that, but her heart really wasn't in it. And he would say, if our lives ever get reduced to what goes in and out of that cracker box, we may as well be dead. I get the impression that Jesus was deeply stirred on more than one occasion by impulsive expressions of love, that he felt it was right at times not to be calculating and careful and prudent, but ecstatic and overflowing. Not all the time, but once in a while, the appropriate response. So here was a woman who had not sat down and figured it all out at home before she came, telling herself, well, that ought to be enough. A woman who came, and in a moment of dam-bursting gratitude, poured all of it out. Now, I want you to do something for me. Please think about your own personality for a moment. Because personality is your own private jar of priceless ointment. It is tragic to carry your finest emotions all through life in a jar that is never broken. You let it spill out sometimes. I know people whose reserve is too great. They love, but it never spills over to surprise anybody. I know someone who needs to lose his caution with his child and hug him and say, I love you. You are important to me. You are really going to be something. But he can't because he is reserved. Maybe he's just waiting for an occasion that will be important enough. But life has a way of slipping by, and the perfume jar is never broken. Ask some kids. Ask some wives. Now I'd like to try what I've asked my students to do through the years when they read the Bible. To imagine what is not told. The Bible is in a kind of shorthand. If you hope to fill it in, you have to use imagination. So let's do it. Let's go backwards from this story and reconstruct what may have brought this woman into that room where she would lose her composure and make herself an object of ridicule to everyone except the young rabbi. If she is what we think, a streetwalker, then in some way she would have advertised, like all her sisters of yesterday, today, and tomorrow, dressed as provocatively as the city laws would allow, she would learn how to watch the men who came to look at her as if she were goods on display and they were shopping. The ones who were young and nervous, still touched by a shame that made them ambivalent. And those who could walk easily to some shabby room where their money robbed her each time of a little more self-respect. Now, what if a man comes by one day and speaks to her respectfully, as if she is as good as anyone else, and then goes on? And what if after a few times he stops one day and simply gazes quietly into her eyes? In a kind of trained response, she flirts with her eyes and moves suggestively her stock in trade. And to her surprise, he looks regretful and goes away again. But it happens several times like this until she wonders what kind of kook this is, but also finds herself looking forward to his arrival because he seems to want nothing from her but the recognition that one human being can give to another. She finds that the coldness she has cultivated deep down to freeze her feelings and make her kind of life possible is beginning to thaw out. She finds herself looking forward to seeing this man come and pause for a moment to say hello and to seem to be waiting for her to find something she has lost. She is almost like a young girl in love. And so one day, from deep inside what she once was, a kind of innocence rises and wipes the seduction out of her eyes. She lifts them naked and vulnerable to his, and she sees now how sad his eyes are as he thinks of what she has done to herself. Eyes that see the woman who might have been, might still be, the woman who longed, as we all do, to love and to be loved, not bought and used and forgotten. The woman looks into his eyes, sees what he sees when he looks at her, and a tear comes unbidden. He smiles at her then, and she smiles back, and he leaves. She tries to go on with her profession, but his face keeps coming between her and the face that has bought her for a few minutes, and the coldness that had protected her before won't come back. And so slowly, but with great certainty and a growing joy, she knows she cannot go on. The memory of respect and love in that other face slowly heals her, and she becomes unemployed. And then one day, she sees him near a door at a banquet. She can't help herself. She wants to thank him, but she is tongue-tied, embarrassed before the others, unable to whisper the simple words, "Thank you, sir." So the tears start and fall on his feet, and he feels them and turns and smiles, surely, because he knows his love has been redemptive as he intended. And she drops in her confusion and distress to undo what she has done, to wipe off the tears with her hair and everybody in the room is struck dumb at the sight of it. "Do you see this woman?" he asks Simon, who, of course, sees her, but does not see her at all. Sees only the category into which he has placed her, which is what we all do with one another far too often to protect ourselves. And asking Simon that question, he also asks us, "Do you see this man who on the surface is a lord of business and in command of himself and almost everybody else, but is actually terrified and lonely in ways he has no words even to describe? Do you see this woman who has created a mask you do not like in order to hide the face she thinks the world will consider weak?" If we have deeply paid attention, we can go home with two directives from the Lord of life. One is to see people with his eyes so that we bring new hope to them. And the other is to act at times on an impulse of love without worry about cost or dignity. Love, this little story says, does not only do good things, love does lovely things. Once in a while, recklessly, without counting the cost.